Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the governor's veto of a bill that would have allowed clinical use of magic mushrooms has some disappointed.
And we'll meet a local grandma who says selling products on TikTok has changed her life.
But first, with all of the talk about tight races and close calls heading into this year's election, KJZZ's political editor, Ben Giles, is here this morning to tell us there are not that many races that are actually contested this primary season. And that's not necessarily a new thing. Hi there, Ben.
Good morning.
Okay, so when we say there aren't that many contested races, actually, and this is, of course, notwithstanding really big ones, right, coming up and after the primaries, what do we mean? Like, how many are actually in play?
Well, the thing to remember is when we talk about contested races, most of the time, I think people are thinking, come November, is there going to be a Republican versus a Democrat? Is it going to be this ideological battle at the ballot? Mm-hmm. And there aren't that many truly competitive races in November. So because of that, there's some districts where the primary is simply a race to nominate a nominal challenger. For example, there's three Republicans running in Congressional District 3. None of them stand a chance in November. They're going to lose to whoever the Democratic nominee is in that district. And that's because of redistricting, because of the way the IRC, the Independent Redistricting Commission, has drawn districts. There are some very safe R districts and some very safe D districts. Now, on the flip side, what that means is there are some primaries that are super important because whichever candidate wins the primary is all but guaranteed to go on to win in November, like that CD3 Democratic primary, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, that's likely going to decide who the district's next congresswoman is.
Right, right, because their districts are redistricted in that way. Okay, so let's talk about some of these contested races heading into the primary, the ones we should all be watching for. Let's start with CD1, because it's one. There are Democrats lining up to challenge Republican Congressman David Schweikert, right?
There are so many Democrats lining up that I wrote their names down so I don't forget anyone.
Okay.
Andre Cherney, Marlene Galan Woods, Andrew Horn, Kirk Cromer, Connor O'Callaghan, and Amish Shaw, six Democrats running to hopefully be the Democrat to finally defeat David Schweikert in November. Schweikert has won that district in consecutive campaigns, but his margin of victory has been shrinking over time. So there's a hope that this year, one of the six on the Democratic side could advance and take him on. Mm-hmm. But this has been a tough primary for the candidates to, you know, really distinguish themselves from one another. For example, they've all made access to reproductive rights a staple of their campaign. So in one regard, Galan Woods might have a built-in advantage because of that, because she's the only woman in the race. It's one woman versus five men. In an election year when abortion is very much important to voters, there's a strong tie between female candidates and that issue. On the flip side, she has been attacked by some of her opponents for her past GOP ties, so it's unclear how much that will matter to voters come July 30th.
Okay, let's talk about a similar situation on the other side of the aisle in CD8, where Republicans are lining up to replace outgoing Congresswoman Debbie Lesko in the West Valley. This is a safe Republican district. Who are you watching?
Right. Whoever wins this GOP primary is likely going to be the next congressman for the West Valley. This appears to be a battle mainly between two failed candidates from 2022. Abe Hamadeh lost the race for attorney general 2 years ago. Blake Masters lost the race for U.S. Senate in that same election. Both, though, are interesting in that they're carpetbaggers. When they declared to their candidacy, neither of them actually lived in the district. Hamadeh lives in Scottsdale. Masters lived in Tucson, has since moved into the district. And they've both released internal polling that appears to show they've got the upper hand, which is interesting, of course. Hamadeh's polling says he's winning handily. Masters' polling says I'm winning handily. So take that for a grain of salt. But it'll be interesting to watch those two. It'll also be interesting to watch some other candidates for the seat, like House Speaker Ben Thoma. He has real roots in that West Valley district, And he was also endorsed by the outgoing Congresswoman, Debbie Lesko. Of course, we can't forget about former Congressman Trent Franks running again. Remember, this is the guy who asked his congressional aides to help with a surrogate pregnancy.
Yes.
And backed out of office from there. And now he's back.
He's back. All right. So let's move on to CD3. We have two major Democratic nominees battling it out to replace Representative Ruben Gallego, who is, of course, running to replace outgoing independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema. A long line here. Who's in the running?
So this is a battle between former Democratic Party Chair Raquel Tehran and former Phoenix Councilwoman Yasmin Ansari. It's another race where it is really tough to distinguish the candidates on the issue. So it feels like this is a bit more of a battle over leadership style. Tehran comes from a long history of Democratic organizing, campaigning. She was leader of the Democratic Party when it had some really big victories in statewide races 2 years ago. Mm. Ansari is viewed a little bit more as like a collaborative candidate. The Phoenix City Council, you've got to work across the aisle a little bit there. That's not something that Democrats and Republicans really do well at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And Tehran's other experience is serving at the state legislature.
Okay. Let's move on down to the county level races. There are a few interesting races in Maricopa County that are really up for grabs, including for the County Board of Supervisors.
Yeah, in District 2, I think that is the race to watch. You've got incumbent supervisor Republican Thomas Galvin trying to fend off a challenge from a former state lawmaker, a one-time candidate for the Secretary of State's office, Michelle Ugenti-Rita. This has been, at least when it comes to Ugenti-Rita's race, a real mudslinging campaign. Mm-hmm. If you follow these campaigns on X, formerly known as Twitter, this is basically just attack, attack, attack. Galvin is this, in her words, this establishment Republican who's not getting anything done. Ugenti-Rita has kind of leaned into some of the more far-right tendencies of the Republican Party. She got endorsed by failed Secretary of State candidate Mark Fincham recently. Mm-hmm. Those are two kind of odd birds to see together. So it's interesting to see how things will play out in D2.
Okay, last 30 seconds, let's talk about another big race, the recorder's race, Maricopa County Recorder. Republican Stephen Richer has really made a name for himself as someone who refused to join the Trump crowd and say that the election was rigged, but he's facing a challenger who will.
Yeah, yeah. And we saw that play out just over the weekend. There was a candidate forum in Sun City, a heavily Republican area of the Valley. And Richer was asked on stage, was the 2020 election stolen? And Richer has been very, very adamant, very proactive in saying, no, these elections are not stolen. They're fair and safe. His candidate or his opponent, on the other hand, Republican Justin Heap, who comes from the state legislature, has not been as shy about entertaining that aspect of the Republican base. So this is a bit of a battle for the integrity of elections.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. KJZZ's Ben Giles, our political editor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a bill last week that would have legalized magic mushrooms for medical treatment, but at the same time extended funding for research into the psychedelic drug, also known as psilocybin. Some say it's putting the science before the legalization. Others say it's keeping the treatment inaccessible for many who could benefit from it. And that includes our next guest, Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Good morning there, Will.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Okay, so why do you think it would have been a good idea for the governor to sign this bill legalizing clinical therapy with magic mushrooms? What's the argument?
Well, I think the argument is there are people out there with PTSD who have heard anecdotally some pretty convincing stories about the effectiveness of magic mushroom or psilocybin treatment for their condition, and that it is also something that's not ongoing. Like it can be a couple of episodes of treatment and then you're good to go. Mm-hmm. So there's these stories out there that are pretty compelling, and people with PTSD who said, geez, I'd like to try that. And what the bill would have done is charged the state health department with creating a new category of licensed clinical facility that would allow they call them guides, I think, but a technician or a clinician to help guide people through their psilocybin treatment. And so it would have been a licensed facility in a a therapeutic environment and regulated by the state health department. But ultimately, as you said, the governor vetoed it. And your statement at the beginning where you said it's either this or that, it's really both of those things.
Sure.
There's limited published evidence that this is an effective treatment, lots of anecdotal evidence, and people who want to use the therapy who were hoping that they would have that opportunity in Arizona. There's other states they can go to. Like
sure.
Oregon.
Right, right. I mean, so what do you make of this argument that there's not enough research? It sounds like you agree there's not a ton, you know, but and the governor's psilocybin research advisory board told her basically like they don't have enough research yet to support, I think the quote was, widespread clinical expansion.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, there is really, like I said, it's mostly anecdotal. There's really no published evidence that this is effective, but lots of anecdotal stories. Now, there's people who said, I've tried everything, and I'd like, and everyone's telling me that mushrooms are a really good way to go, and now I can't do that. So she's true. That is true, that the evidence is pretty lacking. And as you mentioned, there is $5 million from last fiscal year that got extended into this next, I think maybe even indefinitely, so that research can continue in Arizona, but there won't be the kinds of clinics where people could go in and get that treatment now since the bill was vetoed.
So there's a comparison, or I guess a contrast, to the legalization of marijuana here, right, which you were very involved in when you were serving as the director of the state health department. A lot of folks will say, you know, we did that backwards, sort of like we have legalized marijuana and now a lot of the research is playing catch up. Do you agree?
Well, yes. And there's a reason why that's true is because both marijuana and mushrooms the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, calls those Schedule One drugs, which means they don't work and they have a potential for abuse. So that makes it really, really hard to do the research, because now you're putting in for a grant, for example, to say to the granting agency, you know, National Institutes of Health, we're going to give people an illegal drug and test it on them. And so it's really hard to get funding for those kinds of things because it's in that Schedule One category.
So does this come down to the federal level then, in your mind?
Well, yeah. I mean, because the mushrooms, as I said, are in Schedule One, just like marijuana. By the way, they're in the process of rescheduling marijuana down to Schedule Three.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a common – I haven't heard of an effort to reschedule mushrooms. Yeah, it's a real – this Controlled Substances Act goes back to the 1970s and hasn't really been adjusted. Now, the agencies that implement it can change their regulations over time, but I really honestly think it's time for a CSA, Controlled Substances Act, overhaul at the Congress level. Mm. Now, these days, it seems like that's something impossible to do.
So let me ask you about the state of research into this here in Arizona now with that funding that has now been extended. Are we sort of a leader in this? Like you mentioned there are other states where you can go in and use magic mushrooms clinically, but it seems like we are sort of at the forefront.
Yeah, this is unique in that there's actually state general fund money that's appropriated $5 million for this research. So that's a really unusual thing. Mm-hmm. It's unusual in Arizona for the state to invest in something like that. And it's also unusual across the country. So, yeah, I would call us a leader in that respect. Now, having said that, the money was there a year ago and not anything has been done. Mm-hmm. So there hasn't been any research. So that's why they had to extend the $5 million, because it never even got used from the previous year.
Interesting. Okay. So let me ask you in the last minute here before I let you go. The governor and the ledge also approved treatment using MDMA, which is ecstasy, for people suffering from PTSD, but only if it's approved by the FDA. That's already under consideration by the FDA now. Where does it stand?
Yeah. So those drugs are also called Molly and ecstasy, besides MDMA. And also a Schedule One drug, so it's been really hard to do the research on it. However, there has been some PTSD research. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is looking at that evidence, and they expect to issue an approval for that, or disapproval, in August. And if that happens, then the bill the governor signed kicks in, and firefighters and police officers, for example, could get treatment with MDMA and have it be part of workers' comp and stuff. Okay. So, but that all depends on what the FDA does.
Okay. So waiting for that. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Will, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it as always.
Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what makes summer so expensive for working parents in America?
Portugal sounds like a dream come true because they have, I mean, sign me up. They have both private options that are extremely affordable and completely free public options.
One parent tells us how summer childcare in the U.S. measures up to other countries.
But first, it's a big week in EU politics. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, let's kick off this week with the European Union Leaders Summit, which is taking place in Brussels on Thursday. What can we expect to see there?
Well, this is the first full-scale EU summit since European parliamentary elections a couple of weeks ago, which in France saw success for the far-right National Rally, which led President Emmanuel Macron to call a snap parliamentary election. So the EU leaders are still absorbing the outcome of those European elections, and Emmanuel Macron's mind is likely to be on matters at home. But the first order of business this Thursday is going to be choosing who leads the EU for the next few years. The top roles are the head of the European Commission, currently Ursula von der Leyen, and the European Council President, which is currently held by Charles Michel. That role chairs these summits. There was an informal leaders gathering last Monday, but they were unable to agree who should carry things forward for the next few years. Ursula von der Leyen looks as though she has enough support to carry on in her current role, and the front runner for the council president is António Costa, who is the former prime minister of Portugal. The EU leaders will also be looking ahead to the next five-year legislative cycle with a stress on common values, defence and economic competitiveness, and they're due to confirm what they call their strategic agenda at the summit this week.
And more news out of the EU this week. This week also marks the start of formal membership talks for Ukraine. What should we keep an eye on there?
Well, that's right. European Union ambassadors agreed a couple of weeks ago that they would formally start accession negotiations with Ukraine and Moldova, in fact, tomorrow. That was confirmed on Friday. Now, Ukraine originally applied for membership in the weeks after Russia launched its full-scale invasion of the country back in February 2022. It was granted candidate status 4 months later. The willingness to proceed to formal accession talks means that Hungary has, for the time being, dropped its opposition to Ukraine becoming an EU member. Prime Minister Viktor Orban's government, which has close ties to Russia, has previously said it has doubts about the European Commission's assessment that Ukraine is ready to join. The Commission said earlier this month that Ukraine and Moldova both met all the criteria for accession negotiations to formally begin. But it's worth keeping in mind that EU accession negotiations are not speedy at all. The process is likely to take years to be resolved, though the opening of talks with the European Union is likely to be a morale boost for Ukraine, with Russian forces advancing in the Donetsk region and opening a new front in the northeastern Kharkiv region.
Now, Jonathan, speaking of Russia, on Wednesday, the trial of U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich will get underway. Remind us of the background on that case.
Well, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich has been accused of collecting secret information on behalf of the CIA. He was detained by authorities in March of last year in Yekaterinburg. He's the first American journalist to be accused of espionage since the Cold War era. Needless to say, Mr. Gershkovich, his employer, the Wall Street Journal, and the U.S. government say he was just carrying out journalism and dismissed the charges as being baseless. President Biden has called Russia's actions totally illegal. Earlier this month, Russian prosecutors claimed that an investigation had established that the reporter had collected secret information about the production and repair of military equipment from a tank factory. In a statement, they accused him of carrying out, quote, illegal actions using painstaking conspiratorial methods, which, as I mentioned, they claimed were on the instructions of the CIA. Mr. Gershkovich has been held in Moscow's high-security Lefortovo prison since his arrest, 1,000 miles from Yekaterinburg, but the trial will take place in Yekaterinburg from this Wednesday. And Russian authorities confirmed last week that it's being held behind closed doors. There will not be access for journalists to the proceedings. The charges carry a sentence of up to 20 years in jail.
Is there any possibility that Evan Gershkovich could be freed in a prisoner swap?
Well, I think there's always that possibility. Evan Gershkovich's employers at the Wall Street Journal have accused Moscow of stockpiling Americans in Russian jails in order to be able to trade them at a later date. Russia is holding a number of other U.S. citizens in prisons across the country, including several journalists and active duty military members. Keep in mind that back in December 2022, the WNBA basketball star Brittany Griner, who had been arrested shortly before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine for carrying cannabis oil at a Moscow airport, was released from Russian captivity in exchange for the Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout, who had been held in the US for 12 years. Now, you might suggest that swapping an arms dealer who had sold weapons to warlords and rogue governments and been one of the world's most wanted men in exchange for a basketball player who'd been carrying some cannabis oil is not really an equal trade, but that tends to be the nature of these things. In relation to Evan Gershkovich, a Kremlin spokesman said contacts had been made with the US about a possible prisoner swap, but wouldn't comment further. Russia's President Putin has previously said in an interview that he would like Evan Gershkovich to go home eventually, adding, "I say this sincerely, but there's a but." And in this case, it's that the Kremlin wants someone in return. And that someone is thought to be the FSB Security Service officer, Vadim Krasikov, who's serving a life sentence for murder in Germany. The fact that he's held by Germany when Evan Gershkovich is American is likely to complicate matters somewhat.
All right. Well, a lot of intriguing dynamics to keep an eye on there. But finally, Jonathan, this Friday, Iranians go to the polls to select their new president. What is the latest on that race?
Well, you'll remember that this election was called after the late President Ebrahim Raisi was killed in a helicopter crash last month. Six candidates were allowed to be on the ballot, and of those, five are seen as hardliners, with one candidate viewed as being a reformist. Five televised debates have been scheduled, and unsurprisingly, economic issues have been a key talking point in those that have happened so far. Iran's economy has been suffering quite heavily under the weight of Western sanctions, with inflation also soaring. But it's worth noting that economic growth in the year to March 2024 was 5.7%, which would be seen as quite high in many countries around the world. We've also seen polling produced by an Iranian state-linked polling agency in the last few days. That indicates that around 42% of Iranians would definitely be voting, which would be down on a record low turnout for a presidential election when Ebrahim Raisi was elected. The same survey found that more than a third of Iranians are not at all following the election news, although more than a quarter of those surveyed said they'd watched the first presidential debate. And the poll also suggests that the hardliner Saeed Jalili and his reformist rival Masoud Pezeshkian are the most likely to proceed to a runoff vote after this Friday's election. At this stage, it doesn't look as though anyone is likely to get the 50% of the vote required to win it in the first round.
Well, what do we know about those two frontrunners?
Saeed Jalili is a former secretary of the Supreme National Security Council and was head of Iran's nuclear negotiating team. He's thought to be the favorite of Ayatollah Khamenei, who, as supreme leader, is the ultimate decision maker in Iran. In his time as a nuclear negotiator, Mr. Jalili repeatedly stonewalled the talks with five world powers while Iran kept on advancing its nuclear program. He's seen by many as a hardline Islamist ideologue who doesn't really have any executive experience. Now, the exception to the multiple hardline candidates on the ballot is the relative moderate Masoud Pezeshkian. And it's worth noting that in the last presidential election, no reformist candidates were allowed to stand at all. Mr. Pezeshkian is a member of parliament for Tabriz. He's thought to have an outside chance of winning if the turnout in the election is low. He's ethnically Azeri and could well gain votes from some in the northeast of Iran, where the bulk of the population are Turkish-speaking Azeris. There's been some speculation that leaving him in the mix might have been a ploy to push up a turnout that otherwise could be historically low. And we should get the results of the election on Saturday.
All right. Well, lots to keep an eye on. The BBC's Jonathan Frewin joining us this morning. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Lauren, what comes to mind when you picture a social media influencer?
I'm guessing like a youngish, somewhat fame-hungry person.
Same here. But with all the recent news about a possible ban on TikTok and the broader questions about the role of social media on culture, I wanted to talk to someone who lives and breathes it. And that is how I met Tracy Kolkert, a Valley resident with over 500,000 TikTok followers. And Tracy does not fit the profile that you and I are imagining.
Really?
Not at all. She's in her 50s. She has two grandsons. And her relationship with TikTok is much more complex than the pursuit of a massive follower count. When you walk through Tracy Kolkert's front door, the hallway is lined with shelves full of snacks, souvenir drink cups, shampoos, and soaps. Cross into the kitchen, and you'll find a couple racks of clothing and a table piled high with shipping boxes.
Should we start with where I...
Yeah, maybe where...
Maybe you're going to cut this so it doesn't sound crazy?
Yeah, no. The idea is to get an accurate portrayal of what it takes to do it.
In case you didn't catch that, Tracy's asking me to cut this so it doesn't sound too crazy.
We're standing at her kitchen counter, and she's mounting her phone on a tripod.
So I do most of my videos in my kitchen. Even when I do makeup or hair tutorials, oftentimes they're in the kitchen. And I think it makes people feel comfortable that it's not so formal in front of some big, like, makeup mirror or anything that's super fancy. It's realistic and like, hey, maybe you got to put your eyeliner on the kitchen while you're feeding your kids and out the door.
Yeah.
So,
and you got your fridge here with all your...
Tracy turns to the camera and unwraps a protein bar. Suddenly, a golden doodle comes bounding in, leaps up, and puts its paws on Tracy's waist.
Buddy. Buddy. Don't. No, buddy.
He's an excitable guy.
Well, he's still all puppy. So we just got him in January. So.
Buddy is one of several dogs that live with Tracy, not to mention her husband, her friend Megan, and Megan's son. Megan works remotely from the kitchen table. She has a desktop computer set up amidst the boxes and clothing.
I'm a lot of times in the background, or like I'll hand her something, or I'm sitting here giggling because she'll say something and I'm just like...
Tracy's husband chases Buddy out of the kitchen, and Tracy resumes her post in front of the camera. She takes a deep breath and starts recording.
Hey, everybody. We are back. We need a little afternoon snack, a little protein pick-me-up. So we are back with Dive Bar. We had two more from our original 4 trial pack, and I will link that here in case you want to try them for yourself. They have salted caramel pretzel, and then we've got peanut butter chocolate chip.
Back in 2020, like a lot of people, Tracy was stuck at home during the pandemic. And when the NCAA championship was canceled, she had an idea for a TikTok video.
I started March Madness bracketing snacks. I started with pickles. I did the 8. Anything we could find 8 of, we basically did that.
She started with the Elite 8 pickle bracket.
And that blew up. And then people were like, oh, we need to see this for Oreos. We need to see this for Pop-Tarts. We need to see it for those.
I have for you the next Madness bracket.
Cheez-Its! One of my favorites and my daughter's favorites. And she's coming over tonight and we're going to bracket these. I'm super excited. So tonight.
People kept watching and Tracy kept posting. She built an audience based on snack videos. But before long, she started branching out. She posted about books she was reading, lip balm, a desktop iPhone holder that she bought on Amazon.
The new shampoo that I got, which was for hair thinning because I'm getting older and my hair wants to fall out. And then I got some new hair tools. As a 50-plus-year-old lady, I want pretty hair and I want to do all of these things. And so I buy hair tools and test them out and say, hey, if I'm not too old to figure it out, you aren't either. We can all do this together. So I got a deep waiver and then one of those big...
Her strategy, she says, was simple. She just filmed herself doing the things she was already doing, which she admits was often online shopping. But the videos weren't just about the products she was buying. They were also about her.
You know, there was a lot of talk at one point, and I guess it comes around, about niching down and making sure you have your niche. And what is your niche? And I said, I'm me. It's my niche is me. Whatever I want to do that day, whatever I want to talk about that day, if I don't enjoy doing it, it's all going to come to an end. If I get stressed out, if I, you know, am trying to beat an algorithm, I can't do that.
Whatever Tracy was doing, the algorithm really liked it. By the end of 2023, she had over 450,000 TikTok followers. And then someone told her about something called TikTok Shop. Basically, you make a video recommending a product and include a link for people to buy it. If one of your viewers clicks that link, TikTok recognizes that the sale came from your video and you get a commission. Tracy figured she'd give it a try. She posted a video of a table she liked. And lo and behold, some commissions started to trickle in. So she kept going, making the same videos she'd been making all along, but with TikTok Shop links.
And by the end of December, I think I'd made close to $9,000.
Tracy was hooked. One day, she posted a video about a sweater she liked.
And I had originally got a 2XL because I was quite heavier then. And I put it on and it was just so big. And so I was like, well, maybe I need an extra large. And then somebody in the comments had even said, I think maybe even a large. So I went back and got more sizes. And then I came back on and I did a 3 size comparison. Hey, everybody. So if you like a good old comparison video, this is the one for you. Okay. So originally I got this sweater and I'm going to put it on here in 1 second. And I got it in a 2XL. And people are like, this is the most amazing video I've ever seen. And I don't know how many millions of views it has now. I could go look at it, but...
I checked. It's 4.9 million views and counting.
At the end of that day, I had made $14,000.
Tracy's life is complicated. She's got the dogs, the husband, Megan and her son living with her. She's got student loans, old cars that need repairs, and a mortgage. Before December of last year, there were times when Tracy didn't have enough cash to pay the bills at the end of the month. And at first, when the TikTok commissions started flowing into her bank account, Tracy couldn't believe it.
I was like, this sounds fake. I mean, that's more money than I've ever had in a month. And I mean, you're trying to just get through life and make things a little better. The thought of that just was crazy.
But it wasn't fake. Now, several months into selling on TikTok Shop, Tracy says she's paid off her credit cards. She's making progress on the student loans and the mortgage. She's saving up to buy a minivan to replace the old cars.
My goal is, we weren't set up for any sort of retirement. I mean, we were basically on the plan that work until you physically or mentally couldn't anymore.
Yeah.
And now with this is we have a chance to breathe and maybe get there.
When Tracy says she and her husband weren't set up for retirement, that's not because she was just sitting around making TikTok videos before she started selling on the platform. TikTok Shop is just a side hustle.
I'm lucky that, you know, my day job that I work 40 hours is kind of I get to work the 40 hours that I want.
Between working full time and often taking care of her grandsons, Tracy finds whatever extra hours she can to film, edit, and post her videos.
I will say that I'm up late most evenings, very late.
What time do you usually go to bed?
Sometime between about midnight and 2.
Tracy says people sometimes ask her why she's still bothering to work the day job. And when they do, she points to the legislation recently signed by President Biden that could lead to a ban on TikTok. So she's not taking anything for granted. But for now, the extra work is paying off.
In the first quarter of from January, February, and March, I tripled what my actual annual income is at my day job.
Like you tripled what you would make in a year or you're on pace to?
A year.
To me, Tracy's life doesn't sound crazy. Plenty of people have student loan debt and old cars that need repairs and loved ones to take care of and bills to pay. Plenty of people wish they could lose some weight or fill out their hairline or find a protein bar that tastes good and doesn't have too much sugar. I can see how all of that would make you feel a little crazy, especially if you're working a full-time job and still find yourself coming up short at the end of the month. Plenty of people have had that feeling. I sure have. And if you had told me at times in my life when I couldn't make ends meet that what I should do is self-produce free commercials and post them on a social media platform that might not exist in a few months, I think I would just feel defeated. Tracy doesn't feel that way. Sure, sometimes she's trying to make a video and Buddy knocks something over or she gets an email from her boss or her daughter calls to ask if Tracy can pick up her grandson. And in moments like that, she does get momentarily overwhelmed. But no matter how crazy it gets, Tracy just keeps going.
So it's just all kind of happening at the same time. That's amazing.
Yeah, and I think if I waited for the perfect time or moment or whatever to get anything done, no videos would get done. And I think a lot of people always are kind of waiting for the next best time or whatever. And I'm like, just do it in the chaos.
Tracy Colkard's TikTok handle is officially Tracy Time. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. It is summer here in the Valley, and other than incredibly hot temperatures, that means it's time for summer camp. That yearly ritual many of us grew up taking part in, with mixed results. This week on the show, we'll be hearing a new soapbox collection of essays all about summer camp. But first, let's talk about what summer camp looks like for American kids today. For many parents, the words summer camp can be daunting. That's because, especially for working parents, summer means finding stuff for your kids to do and places for them to go. And our next guest says with school out and no real system in place to keep kids safe and busy for 3 months, our country stands out in how it handles summer for kids. Catherine Goldstein is a journalist and creator of the Double Shift Substack, all about working parenthood. I spoke with her more about how other countries handle summer and why it's so hard and expensive for American parents.
So there's about four challenges that I think overlap to make a perfect storm of difficulty for parents in America. We have pretty long summers. Now, this does vary in different regions, and some places do year-round school. But, you know, for the most part, in a lot of places in America, summer is around 3 months long. So that's a lot of time to fill. So problem one. The second problem is that there are very minimal subsidized camp options. Now, there are some cities and some regions do have these, but it's nowhere near the scope of public school, which is basically, you know, where most children between the ages of 5 and 18 are in custodial care, basically, or under the watch of other people.
Yeah.
Another major problem is that we have no mandated vacation time.
Mm-hmm.
And other countries do have that. And filling 12 weeks when some people don't have any paid time off, or they have just a few weeks in the whole year, is really, really challenging. And then the final thing is that, again, there are regional differences with this, but in a lot of areas, the general culture is that children, especially under, say, age 13, need to be supervised by adults. And if they're not being supervised, somehow that's not acceptable or not enriching or not safe.
Right. I want to talk about also, because you've written a lot about this, and I think it's really fascinating because I think my kids are kind of just getting to the age where I'm experiencing this really full throttle. But there's like a crazy scramble that results from all of these kind of challenges, right, to sign kids up for registration. And you kind of have to be in the know and be able to afford it, right?
Yes. So both cost and logistics and having the ability to be at a computer, you know, right at the time registration opens, which, by the way, is not standardized. It's different for every camp. And I have one school-aged child at the moment, and our local Jewish community center, they went to wait list after 1 minute.
Oh, my
gosh.
And
this is for people who are already members of the community center.
Oh, my gosh. So lots of challenges that result from these issues. But what you've done here, which I think is really interesting, is looked at the ways in which this is really unique. So let's talk about how this happens in the rest of the world. You got input from parents in lots of places, in Europe, Nigeria, Mexico. There are a lot of different perspectives. What did they have to say? What stood out to you?
So there's no one way that other countries handle summer, but I would say that if we look at some of our closest sort of economic and cultural brothers and sisters, such as Canada and places in Europe, what I found is that none of those places have all four of the problems that I outlined. So maybe, for example, I have heard that in Canada, there can be really competitive summer camp registration, but there's a much better culture around letting kids go to the pool by themselves. Or once they get a little older, you know, it's not as much they have to be in camp all the time. Like, kids can roam around neighborhoods, that's more common.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have some more subsidized options than the U.S. does. And then on the other end of the spectrum, Portugal sounds like a dream come true because they have, I mean, sign me up, they have both private options that are extremely affordable and completely free public options. When school is out, basically kids can go all day for free in city-run camps. And then also, of course, Portugal is like a beautiful Mediterranean country. So they also have, you know, there's more time off and more sort of culture of people being outside and et cetera. So
yeah, I'm ready.
I'm ready to go.
Let's go. I'm coming. Yeah. But I want to talk more about one of the big cultural differences here, which is this idea you mentioned that kids need constant supervision, especially younger kids. That's unique to America?
Well, our culture of intense supervision is more unique to America and is relatively new in our history.
Right.
So I was born in 1983, so I'm an elder millennial.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually remember back in the day when kids could go to swim team at the community pool, and when they were 7 or 8, just hang out there all day. And as long as they didn't misbehave and they knew how to swim and there were lifeguards, like that was an acceptable way to spend the summer.
Yeah.
So that has changed a lot in one generation. And there's a lot of different factors that go into this. I think it's a combination of economic anxiety about worried about our kids aren't being enriched or they're not getting ahead for like middle and upper class families. I think there's also a lot of fear. There's a lot of media-driven fear about how unsafe the world is. And a lot of that we can understand, you know, there are many factors that make our world feel unsafe, but actually this is the safest time to be a child in basically in America right now in the history of the world, even when you factor in all sorts of other things. Car safety is so much better. So many fewer kids die in car accidents. There are less household accidents. Like, kids are much more likely to make it to adulthood because of our, you know, medical care and vaccines. So mm-hmm. even though it feels really dangerous, there's never been a safer time to be a child.
That's wild. And there's a lot of research being done right now. And I know you've written about this as well, about the effects of that, like the lost kind of
yes.
independence on this generation of kids.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this. I think that there's a bunch of different ways to address this.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is like recognizing that our kids do have maybe more abilities than we think, but it's also changing cultural norms around it. Because if you're like, yeah, I would love my kid to just run around the neighborhood, but nobody else lets their kids run around the neighborhood and everybody else is in summer camp, then your kid has no one to play with.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is also about changing cultural norms around what's acceptable, you know, and also trying to engage some with institutions. Like, for example, our community pool, which I love, actually has a rule that kids aren't allowed to be there by themselves till they're 14 years old, which I think is extreme. But I think also for institutions, liability and worst case scenario is really top of mind for them. So mm-hmm. I'm really excited about there's an organization called Let Grow that has been getting a lot more attention because they're also mentioned in the book, The Anxious Generation, which is about kids and screen time.
Yep.
And I think that re-engaging on childhood independence and really thinking a lot about how many of us were raised, it's not like we have to go back to 1855. Like, we can remember a world that was different. And trying to have those conversations in our communities, I think, is a really, really good start.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So when it comes specifically, though, to summer and to how especially working parents program summer, are there solutions out there in this country that are interesting, that are worthwhile from your point of view?
Well, I think we're at the stage right now where we're just starting to get people to talk about how this is a problem.
Mm.
So we need to raise more awareness of this. And what I would like to see is more joint advocacy between the people who are working on the 0 to 5 space, which is very difficult, very, very expensive. We need large scale solutions for that. But sort of joining that with the summer problems
mm-hmm.
and seeing that this is all part of the same continuum, I think could really help build momentum for, you know, much more comprehensive response. You know, America also has a much stronger tradition of like overnight camps than other countries. And like, none of that is going to go away. Private
yeah.
camps are always going to exist. But there should be safe and affordable and available options for families. It shouldn't have to be a Hunger Games just so you can go to work.
Yeah, it does feel that way sometimes. All right. We will leave it there for now. Catherine Goldstein, journalist, fellow at the Better Life Lab at New America and creator of the Double Shift Substack newsletter. Catherine, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us about this. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
And now let's hear the first essay in our latest Soapbox collection, where we ask local writers to respond to a theme. For so many of us, camp was a summertime ritual with long-lasting memories. But some memories are better than others, as we will learn from our first storyteller, Todd Grossman, who couldn't wait for the end of his first and last sleepaway camp experience.
The big day had arrived. I had no choice. I was going to camp. My Naugahyde child-sized suitcase in hand, I turned to say goodbye to my mother and brothers before boarding the plane. I had never even spent the night at a friend's, and yet here I was, flying across the country to a sleepaway camp in West Virginia, a place I had only heard about in a John Denver song. "You'll be fine," my mother shouted. "I know," I replied. After all, I was 18 years old. Going to National Youth Science Camp was a prize awarded each year to the two outstanding science students in each state. You know, "Here, you've done a great job at the International Science and Engineering Fair, so despite the fact that you've shown zero interest in camping or hiking or being outdoors, we are sending you on a 3-week, all-expenses-paid, deliverance-themed journey into Appalachia." Except for the fact that the campers were old enough to drink, and most were members of Mensa, National Youth Science Camp was exactly what you'd expect. Long, damp walks through tick-infested poison oak, kayak trips preceded by mandatory safety training in an algae-ridden pond. Apparently, science meant having to know how to free yourself from an aquatic fiberglass girdle in the middle of a whitewater rapid. I reminded the counselors that we were scientists, not magicians, but they didn't seem to care. At one point, during a rock climbing expedition, I found myself scrambling up Seneca Rocks, where the guide instructed me to tie the repelling pulley watchamabob to the thingamajigger. Convinced he had mistaken me for an engineer, I shouted down, "Behavioral sciences!" and then proceeded to concoct a series of knots resembling a macrame owl while vowing to learn more about carabiners. I did remember to look out over the majestic landscape, but instead of thinking, "Ah, almost heaven," I checked my rope and muttered, "What am I doing here? I can see the beauty in things. I just don't want to be a part of it. Camp is great if you like sleeping in a room with 30 people and taking cold showers at 5 a.m. with a bunch of spiders. But in that summer, before leaving for college, I missed my friends, who would soon be leaving for school themselves. On the final night of camp, sitting beside the fire, I looked around at the group of weepy, nearly adult science nerds. They were singing Circle Game and were devastated at the prospect of never seeing one another again. It was sweet, and a part of me wanted to join them. But all I could think was, "Take me home, country road.
To the place I belong, West Virginia."
That was Phoenix resident Todd Grossman. You can hear more Soapbox essays at kjzz.org.
All my memories gather round her, miner's lady, stranger to blue water.
All right, that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. If you heard a song you liked on today's show, you can follow us on Spotify. Search KJZZ's The Show on the app, and you will find all the music that we have played last month. For Sam Dingman, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us today. Have a good one.
West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home, country road.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.